supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Ever wonder why people make decisions they regret 10 years down the road, like getting that 18-inch tattoo on your body or rushing to marry that certain someone, both of which turn out to be disastrous in hindsight? Well, new research on what's called the end of history illusion says many of us really underestimate how much will change in the future. Most of us are aware when we look back of how much we have changed. But despite this, we generally believe that who we are now is who we'll be tomorrow. On today's show, what research on the end of history illusion says about how we perceive ourselves and the decisions we make. My guest today is my dear friend, social psychologist Daniel Gilbert. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard and the author of the award-winning international bestseller, Stumbling on Happiness. His latest research is a collaboration on the end of history illusion. It was published recently in the journal Science. Hey, Dan, welcome back to the show.
Dan, how nice to chat with you again. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. How much have you changed in the last decade? And what do you think, who do you think you'll be 10 years from now? Again, that's 888-477-9499. Dan, your article says that our sense of who we are, who we were, and who we will be is not completely accurate. So what does that say about us? How does that work, this illusion?
Well, Dan, we know that people have all sorts of illusions. They make errors, they make mistakes. And when we look forward and backward in time, it's pretty easy to do. You know, we have photographs of what we used to look like, but none of us have very clear images of what we used to be like. And looking into the future is even harder because there's no real person to even look at. So it's not surprising that we make some errors. What interested us, what surprised us, is that the errors seem to be in one direction. I'm 55 years old, and when I look at a photograph of myself when I was 45, I not only notice that I used to have a little more hair, but I think about what a different guy that 45-year-old Dan was. So different, in fact, that it's impossible for me to imagine I'm going to be that different when I'm 65. I don't know if you had the feeling at every point in your life that the Dan Gottlieb you were always meant to be is the one you have finally arrived at, and now you're pretty much done changing. But what our research showed is that people seem to believe this about themselves from the age of 18 to the age of 68. At every single age, people told us, oh my gosh, I've changed a lot in the last 10 years. And at every single age, they told us, but I'm not going to change very much in the next 10.
Well, I wonder about this, because I look back, I when I was researching for the show today, so I took time and looked back over my life. And, you know, I changed in hindsight dramatically from 5 to 15, from 15 to 25. But as I aged, as I look back on it, I changed a bit less as I got older. So my change from 55 to 65 was not as dramatic as it was from 45 to 55. So I wonder if that curve begins to flatten out a bit.
Well, there's no doubt it does. On virtually every dimension, change slows down. And you only need to look at a person changing from the age of 1 to 10 and another person changing from, say, 71 to 80. And you see, the first set of changes is dramatic. The person changes in size. The person learns to speak. The person learns to walk. So your observation is exactly right. Change does slow. The question is, do we know how much it will slow? And what we were able to do with our research was actually see if people overestimated or underestimated the slowing of future change. And all of the data we collected suggests that people underestimate and drastically underestimate the future change ahead. Even though it's less than it was the last 10 years, it's still more than you think it's going to be.
This sounds like it's continued or further developed thinking about your research that went into your book, Stumbling on Happiness. And the first thing I remember reading about that in reading in your book was when you said all of our decisions are about making our future selves happy, but we don't know anything about who our future selves will be and what will make them happy.
Well, you have a very good memory. This is, of course, more research that picks up on many of the themes that emerged in Stumbling on Happiness, which is, you know, approaching its 10th anniversary. It is true that our decisions, almost every decision we make, is a decision about a future self. Now, you know, when you look down at a piece of pizza and say, do I want it or not, that's a decision that your present self is going to consume or live with. But virtually every other decision we make is really about something that's going to affect us in the future. And so our ability to make decisions and make them well requires that we have some sense of who our future self will be. In the paper in Science that we're talking about now, we ended with a study that looked at whether the end of history illusion could bedevil people's decision making. And we did a very simple study. We asked people to name their favorite musical band from 10 years ago, and they named it. And we said, how much would you pay right now to see a concert from that band you used to love 10 years ago? And I forget the exact numbers, but I think they told us that they would pay somewhere around $80. Now, we asked everybody to also predict for us how much they would pay in 10 years to listen to their current favorite band. And there they told us they would pay $130. Now, there's a big disparity between these two numbers, and that disparity is because you don't realize that 10 years from now, the band you love so much that you think you'd pay $130 for them will only be worth $80 to you. Very simple demonstration of how this illusion about history having come to an end can cause us to make bad decisions.
I wonder if the underpinnings of this, or one of the byproducts, is why people have identity crises in the first place. I mean, they're really not crises per se. They're challenge to our perception that we will always be who we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot to be said for the comfort of stability. People ask, all right, you've demonstrated this end of history illusion. Why does it happen? And the right answer scientifically is we don't yet know. But it's pretty easy to speculate. And one of those speculations is right in line with what you just said. One of the reasons we probably underestimate how much we're going to change in the future is change is a little bit scary. And it feels pretty good to think that we finally arrived at the destination, we finally arrived at the place that we can now live out the rest of our lives without having to worry about cataclysmic, catastrophic change that might lie ahead.
Let me give out the numbers. We're talking with social psychologist Dan Gilbert about the end of history illusion. He's the guy that wrote the best-selling book, Stumbling on Happiness. Our number is 888-477-9499. Why do you make the decisions you do, the long-term decisions, even the long-term goals? What is your image of who you will be 10 years from now, even 5 years from now? Love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. You know, you talked about the end of history illusion. This kind of goes along with our vision of ourselves as a species. You know, there's kind of an assumption there that we are no longer evolving, that we have evolved, that we're the top of the line. Doesn't get any better than us.
Well, that's right. You're right. It is mimicked in our biological evolution, which, like our psychological change over a lifetime, has indeed slowed. But that doesn't mean that we're correctly estimating the amount of change that's still in front of us.
I want to come back to the idea of the identity crisis. And, you know, I can talk about something dramatic like what happened to me 33 years ago when, you know, I had my accident and I thought I was a psychologist father. And all of a sudden, I became a quadriplegic. And that was my identity. And I was in crisis because I didn't know what that meant. I think of a woman who came into my office and she was chair of a department at a university and she lost the chairmanship and she had an identity crisis because she thought that's who she was. And, you know, this whole issue of identity is kind of an illusion altogether, isn't it?
Well, I think identity is one of the many things that we achieve in our lives, and it's one of those things that we think that once we achieve it, it's ours to keep. In that sense, it almost reminds me of something like happiness. People often ask me, you know, how can I be happy? And what they mean by that isn't, how can I be happy for an hour? They mean, how can I be happy permanently? To which the answer is, you can't. Happiness isn't something you own. It isn't something you get and then you get to keep forever. Rather, it's something that you achieve and that changes and you re-achieve each day. I think the same thing is true about identity. Our identities are in constant flux. But the rate at which identity changes is slow enough that we don't notice it. So our identities don't usually change from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed. You know, we live at a small human scale on the timeline. We notice things that change by the second, by the minute, maybe by the hour. But once things start to change only by the month or the year, we lose sight of them. It's just a matter of scale. And I think that's really what happens with identity. It does indeed change. And I think most of us are surprised when it does.
Yeah, it's kind of like what happens with hair, huh?
It's interesting you bring that up because you and I know each other and both of us are follicularly challenged, as you might say. But I bet if you asked people to predict the amount of physical change that they're going to experience in the next 10 years or the amount of financial change, I bet they'd be very good at doing that. We all recognize that our bodies are going to wear out, that as we progress in our careers, we'll probably make a little more money, things like that. It's these core aspects of the self that our research suggests people don't understand are also going to change.
Why is that? Why do we have a more clear, realistic sense of our bodies and less so of our being or mind?
Well, I think, first of all, we're highly motivated to believe that the person we've become is the person we're going to be for a long, long time. You can't really maintain that illusion about your body. I mean, nobody who's 25 says, wow, look at me. I guess I'll just stay this way forever. I mean, if you believe that, you're really not paying very close attention, are you? But other people's personalities seem to us from the outside to be pretty stable. We don't notice that they're undergoing changes. You know, Dan, you could undergo an identity shift in maybe the last 12 months that I, as an outside observer, might not be privy to. So I have the illusion looking at you that you're a very stable character. And then I make the same mistake about myself. So many of the changes we're talking about aren't things that you can see from the outside like physical changes are. And so I think we have deficient theories about how much change we're going to experience.
You would, you would notice my change right away. I've become enlightened, Dan.
You were already enlightened.
let's go to the phones. We've got Ann on the line. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things that I've been thinking about as you've been talking about change and rate of change is whether there's anything to do with gender in it. I'm 70. I made a major life change 15 years ago. It took me maybe 3 or 4 years to make the decision, and I felt myself growing as I came to that point. And afterward, it took me maybe another 5 years to find myself, the interior me and make it the exterior me. And I don't know if this would happen in men because they're making decisions I mean, I'm retired now, but I was working, but not in a upper level position. Well, I'm just wondering if gender has something to do with it.
Can you tell us a bit about your process? Like, what was happening with you that you made this decision, if it's not too personal, what the decision was? Because you're tying this process up with identity.
A lot of it was how much I could live with the situation I was in before I decided to change it. Part of it was knowing that where I was in my job, which had nothing to do with the change, was pretty static. I mean, I had a job that I really liked, and I knew it was static. I knew there was no growth for me in the period in the job, and that was okay. And then, because of exterior circumstances, the people involved in me coming to, I decided I had to do it. I had to take the step, and it also, well, concurrently with medical menopause and taking a course through my church about the place, the role of woman in religion, in history. So they kind of all came together, and I said to myself, well, oh, yeah, I think I'm stronger than I ever thought I was. And I've gotten to the point where I have to make this change.
Did you have a sense? I want to come to this end of history illusion, and I'm going to maybe take a question out of Dan's book. When you were making these changes, did you have a vision of who you would be 5 years hence?
No, I'll tell you, the motive force in actually making it was hearing a sermon in which Mary Oliver's poem called A Summer Day was quoted. It ends, "And what are you going to do with the rest of your one wild and precious life?" And my instantaneous answer was not, "I'm going to do X, Y, or Z." It was, "I'm going to be happy." And I knew that getting to happy was a process. It was not a, you know, go out and buy a Jaguar. That wouldn't make me happy. But it was something that I wanted to work toward and that I knew I wasn't able to do in the situation I had been in.
Dan?
Will, you're the clinical psychologist. I'm just a scientist. And, of course, the first question I heard was, you know, are there differences between genders? Certainly in the data we've collected, the experiments and the paper you began by describing, Dan, include, close to 20,000 people. We didn't see any evidence of gender differences, at least in the things we measured. Men and women, young people and old people alike, all underestimated how much they would change in the future. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't any gender differences out there in the world. It just means in the couple of domains that we measured, personality, people's basic values, people's basic preferences, men and women were equally prone to the end of history illusion.
Now, I will say this, and that as a clinician, I don't have a ton of data, but just my personal experience. As a clinician, women are more likely to know they are suffering earlier than men will. And therefore, women are more likely to make a decision like that earlier based on their own suffering than men will. Men will, all of a sudden, you know, when it builds up and builds up, are more likely to see some kind of an emotional explosion. Women are more in touch with process. Now, that's a sweeping generalization, and there's dozens and dozens of exceptions, but that's just my observation. Meanwhile, you sound happy you made the changes you did, and that makes me happy. So thanks so much for your call, and I wish you the best. We are going to take a short break. We're talking with Dan Gilbert, professor of psychology at Harvard, author of Stumbling on Happiness, and we're talking about the end of history illusion. It's really about our identity. Who are we? Who do we think we are becoming, and actually, who do we think we are now? Our numbers, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. How has your identity changed over the years, and how do you anticipate it changing in the future? Again, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. University of the Sciences accepts transfer students into its undergraduate degree programs and offers convenient evening office hours to help students with their questions and learn about the admission process. Students can also find out about starting or furthering their career in pharmacy, chemistry, healthcare business, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and more. More online at usciences.edu/transfer.
Well, I think in 5 or 10 years, I probably won't be the same person just because I'll be in school for the next 5 years. Always, school changes me, changes my views and everything.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb talking about our identities with Professor Daniel Gilbert. Dan, what we just heard was the exception to your rule, apparently.
Well, not necessarily. That sounded to me like a pretty young person, and she was talking about how she expects to change over the coming years. The question isn't, does she know she'll change? The question is, does she know how much? And my guess is that even people like her, at least our data suggests, even young people who say, oh boy, I'm going to be pretty different, are surprised at how different they actually are going to be.
Tell us about the study itself, Dan.
Well, in these studies, this is a series of studies. We did something that I think was kind of clever, and I can say that because I didn't invent it. One of my co-authors did. You know, the best way to find out whether people estimate properly the amount of change that they're going to experience is to ask them, how much are you going to change in the next 10 years? Then you wait 10 years, and you see if they were right. But scientists don't like to wait 10 years. We don't want to wait a decade for the answer to this question, so we came up with another way of doing the study. We asked people at every age to predict how much they were going to change in the next 10 years, and also to report how much they had changed in the last 10 years. By doing a fancy statistical analysis of these two numbers, we can show that if for any given decade, let's take the decade from 20 to 30, people who are 20 anticipate changing much less in that decade than people who are 30 remember having changed in that decade. And that's true for every decade from 18 to 68. So essentially what we see is, just think of a timeline, and you've got one young person standing on one side of it and an older person, 10 years older, standing on the other side. The young person's looking forward and they say, you know, I'm going to change, but, you know, not that much. And the person looking backward is saying, oh my gosh, have I changed a lot. That essentially captures our finding.
I watched one of your TED Talks, and you gave the audience two scenarios. You asked them to guess which one would give them greater happiness, winning the lottery or becoming a paraplegic. And, of course, everybody guessed winning the lottery. And your
exactly.
Response?
Yeah. Well, as you know, from the 1970s forward, studies of people who have lost either the use of two or four limbs in accidents, and studies of people who win the lottery, show us that the difference between these outcomes is just not very dramatic. And in fact, sometimes the difference goes in a direction you wouldn't expect. For example, the very first study of these two populations showed that one group found it difficult to take pleasure in everyday experiences. Unfortunately, it was the lottery winners. So the point of this exercise, of course, isn't that rather than buying a lottery ticket, maybe you should go get in a car accident. The point is that the difference between these two outcomes seems in prospect very, very dramatic. But when we go and measure the actual emotional well-being of people who have experienced both of these outcomes, you don't find a very big difference. Sometimes you don't find a difference at all.
Ergo, all of the burgeoning research now on post-traumatic growth that, you know, the majority of people who experience trauma wind up growing as a result. And again, that's not something we recommend. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Itka on the line.
You know, I'm sorry, my phone is misbehaving, and I cut out there for a second. Give me 1 second for technical difficulties.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let's listen to your call. If Dan's not here, we'll repeat it for him, okay?
Okay. I feel that I am the luckiest unlucky woman because I'm a Holocaust survivor, and I was only 13 years old when the Holocaust began. And my entire family perished, and 6 million Jewish people perished, and I survived. And the most important thing, I didn't survive with bitterness, because I appreciate that I am alive, the only one of the family. And then in America, I had many misfortunes. I had a 26-year-old son, and he was killed in a car accident. My late husband also died in a car accident. And recently, I live in a two-story home, and I walked up, I fell down from all the flight of stairs, and I was laying for 20 hours till they found me. But I'm grateful I'm still alive. And what I've been doing since 1970s, I write poetry, my book. Thank you for listening to my story. And I appreciate Dr. Dan Gottlieb for your program that I enjoy immensely, and I learn every day.
You still there?
Yes.
Okay, don't go away. I want to talk to you a little bit. Okay?
Okay.
Now, I wonder, do you have any idea about why this has happened to you? Not the tragedies. They happen. But why you feel so grateful, so blessed to have this life?
I tell you why. Because I didn't use my Menschlichkeit, which means humaneness, because they used to be in my family, they used to say, as one is to seven, so is to 70. I was blessed with a very loving, caring family till the Holocaust. And I never forgot. And my mother used to tell me, you only have what you give away. And as long as you live, you have something to give. And it's your choice. You can give kindness, or you can give hatred. And I'll just tell you just one poem that I said in Auschwitz. I feel like a bird with clipped wings, tied to this earth by invisible strings, chained to a destiny I did not choose. I feel like a prisoner that cannot break loose. I look at the sky with a heavy sigh, but my wings have been clipped, and I cannot fly. Physically, I felt like my wings have been clipped. Emotionally, I feel I'm the luckiest, unlucky woman. Because from every tragedy, I learned something, and I still keep on writing and speaking publicly. So I feel, as long as I have something to give, life is worth living.
You know,
thank you kindly.
Yes, thank you. And bless your heart, you're a wonderful teacher for all of us. Now, what we're hearing is Itka's resilience here, and we're hearing all of the factors that go into it, that go into her attitude. First of all, she had wonderful, loving parents, and look at the kind of teachers they were before she was age 13, that, you know, it is about what you give away, and that generosity of spirit changes the way you look at life. So we hear that, and then we hear that she was able to write poetry and make a contribution to the world, so that she always had, even in the darkest of times, she always had her eyes on the bigger picture and not just on herself. And finally, it's about her gratitude for life. And we know about gratitude and people who are able to acknowledge what they're grateful for and even experience gratitude. That alone can change their lives. I've had patients who I've had keep gratitude journals, and what we find is it actually changes the wiring in their brain, and they begin to see what's good in their lives and focus less on what's negative in their lives. It gives just a wonderful, wonderful role model and teacher for these lessons. We've had some technical difficulty. I did not hog the conversation from Dan Gilbert because I'm that kind of guy. We're having technical problems getting Dan on the line. So we're going to take a short break, but please keep calling in. We'll take your phone calls. We're talking about identity and how they change, what goes into them, who you were, who you are, and who you think you will be. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And we're hoping in just a couple of minutes we'll be able to get back Dan Gilbert, who's the author of Stumbling on Happiness. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Garrett and Tatiana Copeland Arrhythmia Center at ChristianaCare offers care for people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too slowly, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. For more information or to make an appointment, 800-693-CARE or ChristianaCare.org/arrhythmia.
Through all the ups and downs of his dieting and weight loss, TV weatherman Al Roker kept a smile on his face even when the rude comments poured in. Well, later for that.
You know, I thought you were funnier when you were fatter. Yeah. I said, yeah, and I thought you were smarter before you opened your mouth.
Al Roker tells us about his new attitude in his new book. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I always hope to keep learning and keep growing in new ways, so I think it would be pretty hard to predict my precise interests, though I think my outlook and personality will be the same.
Now, that is an interesting point. Who we are and who we are deep down inside our core selves. You know, when I look back over my life, there's a core inside of little Danny in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And that core, I think, has remained the same. The externals have changed. Maybe even my personality has changed over the years. Well, I'm sure it has. But that core has been the same. And what I've discovered, and a lot of people as they age say this, that we become, if we're lucky, more of who we are. Not different, but more of who we are. And I think that happens when we open up to the truth of our lives, when we open up to the simple fact that we really don't know about the future. You know, I talked about wanting to eliminate that PhD after my name and write DKS. You know, don't know. We don't know. We just don't know anything. So give us a call. We're talking about identity, who you were, who you are now, and how it's changed over the course of the years. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're having a terrible time with getting Dan Gilbert, so it looks like we might be hanging out for the rest of the show, you and me. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's talk with David. Hey, David. David? Do we have you, David?
Oh. Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say real quick, you're absolutely right about us changing the core of us, of who we are, comes through a little bit later in life as we become more introspective as we grow. I think my example is, you know, my story is a bit like a lot of people, like the one caller that you had. You know, there's something in their life that propels them to change and they're not sure what it is. I think that, you know, as we're early young adults, we don't really understand how much we're going to change because our reference point is short. We don't have a history to look back on. But as we come into our late 30s and our 40s, we're realizing that this journey takes us to a place and we'll have a number of different changes. And it's how we appreciate the changes and how we accept them and how we look and learn to grow. In my mid-30s, I was in a bad situation and I didn't like where I was. I was, you know, distracted from my family and I was, I knew I had to do something. And as I began to change, I got closer with my family and I met someone who, you know, brought the best out of me. And to this day, here we are, you know, 13, 14 years later, and I'm still growing. And I'm always told by my family that, you know, you're who you always were. You're now turned into who you always were. And I think, you know, it gives it, we must, you know, want to change and then accept it and embrace it and then kind of navigate it with some help.
Tell me about your relationship with yourself over those years?
Wow, that's a great question. With myself, up until I decided to change, I never really paid attention to the things that I wanted. And I never really thought of my potential. I never really, saw my true potential. And I think years of ignoring myself and ignoring what was important to me and the shallowness of things that people attract themselves to, it has changed dramatically, even in the last 5 years, even in the last 4 months. I mean, I'm in a constant mode of change and growing. But now, you know, I'm at my age of 47. I there's nothing I can't achieve. I'm always learning and growing and with, you know, constantly speaking to either family members or a therapist and all. It's one of those things where I can appreciate everything now, and I like who I am.
Do you have a vision of 10 years from now? What that's going to be for you? Who you're going to be?
That was a question. That was a question I was asked. How much change at this point can I expect? And I would assume it's changing so rapidly, I don't really have a vision, but I know I want to continue to grow, and I want to continue to achieve the things that are important to me. Right now, I'm in, over the last several months, of how I can affect positively the things and the people around me. And this is something I just grabbed hold of, you know, for the last few months. But that is important to me, and that's where my focus is. Not so much on myself, but affecting the others around me positively, and looking for change for the better.
What do you mean affecting them?
Well, I suppose what I value is to try and help people. When I say affecting them, I mean instead of turning a blind eye for someone who may need help or, you know, trying to do more to help people in my own way, whether it be through, you know, charitable contribution, whether it's time or effort. It's something that I've learned to value over the last several months into the year.
Wonderful. I appreciate your call. It's nice to hear where you are in life.
Well, thank you.
Take care.
All right.
Well, you know, one of the things David talks about that I think might be present in all of us, if, you know, we can be grandiose, is he wants to make the world a better place. And I think ultimately we all do. We talk about needing to make a contribution. And Yeah, we all want to make the world a bigger place in some way, shape, or form. Let's go back to the lines. We're talking about identity, who we are now, how we see ourselves now, who we were. And I guess the other thing with the identity that I want to ask is that way we beat ourselves up, that way we judge ourselves, has that critical judge changed over the years? Do you expect it to change in the future? Let's go back to the lines and speak with Uma. Hi, Uma. Do we have you? Hello, Uma.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. And my comment was, as a practicing Hindu, what we are taught is our real identity is the consciousness within each of us. And over a period of time, as the impediments caused by our mind and intellect recede and our mind and intellect becomes more subtle, the light of the consciousness shines through and we find ourselves becoming more generous and more giving. And as a result, we experience more happiness in spite of trying circumstances.
So as the intellect recedes, the light shines brighter.
Yes, that is a finding, because the intellect comes in the way, because true happiness is beyond the grasp of the intellect.
Yeah, it's so the mind is not all it's cracked up to be, is what you're saying.
Definitely, it's when the mind and intellect stop their running around, whether it's around objects or around ideas and notions, mm-hmm. is when your true identity, which is the consciousness which is in all living beings, shines through.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it is the mind. Of course, it's hard to get the mind to recede without a lifetime or two of practice at that. But I think it's important, Uma, to acknowledge that the mind, the intellect, those thoughts aren't necessarily true or valid and aren't necessarily helpful. They're just activities of a mind, just activities. Mm-hmm. And if we can somehow learn to dishonor that and look at what's happening in our mind from a broader perspective, that light is much more likely to shine. Uma, thank you so much for your call and what you've been able to teach us. Thank you. Uma reminds me that, when people ask me if I'm out of my mind, I often say no, but I'm trying. I am trying. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Charlie on the line. Hey, Charlie.
Hello, Dan. Can you hear me?
Sure. Hear you well.
Thank you. Good. Thank you for taking the call. And I'm very excited about the topic today, because I've been going through a thinking process where I kind of look back and realized all the change that I've undergone over the last 10 and 20 years. I'm 64. And how much I valued it, how much I like what I've done and where life has pushed me and where I've driven through it. And it got me very excited about, well, what can I do in the next 10 or 20 years? I sort of see kind of entering a period that I call the third trimester of life, where I still got a lot of life to live and so much more fun to have and things to do and make that world a better place, that whereas rather than looking down like, okay, now here I'm on the downslope, I'm looking for this to be the best.
Hmm.
So have you, that's a comment.
Have you always had that attitude?
Oh, no. No, my family of origin didn't orient me quite this way.
So how did that change?
I think just living and observing, what I learn as I go along and how that affects me, and you know, what I do, what I read, the habits that I form, the habits that I break.
Yeah, it really is all about different habits. We did a show on that, I guess it was several months ago, on a book called The Power of Habit with New York Times journalist Charles Duhigg. And he said much of the way we behave, even the way we think, are habitual, predictable patterns. And that's what you're describing here.
And the way we feel, and that so much is falls out of that.
Even love is habitual. The more we love, the easier it is to love. That's habitual. The more we love, the easier it is, the more we love. Charlie, I want to thank you so much for your call.
And thank you for having me on the show. I've always enjoyed listening to you so much.
Thanks, Charlie. Couldn't do it without you. We have lost our guest, Dan Gilbert. We've had technical problems, phone problems. He's a dear friend of mine and a professor of psychology at Harvard University. I do want to say on the record that when we had him on the show, early in the show, I want it known that this Harvard professor said that I have a good memory. And I want my producers to know, I want my friends and family to know. He said I have a good memory. And he's a tenured professor. So there. We're talking about identity, though. And there's an awful lot to be said. There's an awful lot to be learned about who we are, who we were, and our attitude about that. Let's chat with Jackie. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I know I was listening. I'm in the car, and I just love the show. You made a comment, and I've noticed that a lot of people, they would say things like, you know, if I knew what I know now, I would have done this differently, or I would have done that. And I kind of go back to, if you did have that knowledge, you may not have been, like you said, with how you change, you may not have been capable, though, of doing what you think you would have done now. Do you know, because I think those experiences and the way that it was handled and the way that you went through them at that time has made you who you are now. So you may not have been, you might know all of this now, but even with all that knowledge, you still might not have made those changes back then because you may not have been capable or your personality wasn't developed yet to be able to make those changes.
Well, Jackie, as a radio host, I'm listening, and I think you're right, and I think it's insightful. However, I'm not just a radio host. I'm also a clinician. So are you talking about your life, too?
Well, I mean, there are things, you know, in my life as well that, of course, you look back and, you know, as a child, I was meek, and I was always thinking about everyone else's feelings and things like that. And that is, I think, when you said the core, I am still that type of person. However, the experiences that I've gone through, and I mean, I can even think of the first pretty traumatic experiences. And I think traumatic experiences, like you said before, really do shape you the most. Was when I was 12, and the way it was handled, it was very difficult for me. And I would say, when looking back on my life, that was one of my major personality changes, where I turned a little bit and developed, if you will. Now that I'm looking back, was at 12 years old. And
what,
then I also
tell us. Wait, Jackie.
Yes.
If I don't think it's important to know what happened, but how did you change at 12?
I became someone who started at that point, started slowly, because again, when you're the core personality is a pleaser, which I am, mm-hmm. Where I started being able to start thinking of myself first and start not always, you know, having to do what everyone else you know, says it's the right thing to do.
Well, I got to tell you, just saying that pleased me because at age 12, you began to learn that. And how many people don't learn that until they're 30, 40, 50, or even older? You know, Jackie talks about that, you know, knowing what we knew then. Everybody I know who has been through trauma has said it has changed their lives for the better. I look back over my life. I've lived through multiple traumas. I didn't enjoy any of them. All of them were excruciatingly painful. But there's every one of them, almost everyone, has brought a quality of understanding, something about a knowledge of life. Moreover, a knowledge of myself, that light within, that I have learned over the years that I criticize myself less. I've learned about resilience. And I've got to tell you, every one of my valuable learnings have begun with the phrase, holy crap. This is awful, and it's not going to change. What now? The great learning hasn't come from my accomplishments or my successes. I've had great joys with that. But the learning starts with when something is pulled from my grasp against my will, and I suffer, and I learn. And as one of our callers talked about, when it's pulled away from you, that light shines even brighter. And I wish that for all of us. We were talking with Dan Gilbert about self-perception. We will have to have him back on again. Next week, we're going to be talking about conspiracy theory mentality. Some interesting research on that. Well, you can comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices, and you can download this and other shows there or on iTunes. Email me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Thanks to all of you. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a good week.